Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. The love between a mother and child is considered sacrosanct. There is nothing stronger. And when a mother murders her own child, it is unimaginable, abominable, and culturally unforgivable. Then we have cases of mothers who kill their newborn immediately after birth. The legal term is neonaticide. These are almost always blamed on socioeconomic issues. It's why we have safe haven laws. The murder or sacrifice of a newborn baby by its mother goes back to ancient times. With too many mouths to feed, women made brutal choices. In some cultures, girls were killed more than boys. It's no secret that historically, boys were valued much more than girls. Typically, ancient neonaticide was caused by desperate societal pressure, whether it was poverty or the stigma of illegitimacy. In 1624, England passed a law meant to stop mothers from passing off murdered babies as stillborns. But it did more harm than good. If you gave birth without a witness and the baby died, you could be charged with murder without any real proof. And our current safe haven laws are not really a modern solution. In the early 18th century, foundling hospitals seemed to help combat the ancient shame of women snuffing out their newborns. But it still happens. Some women cannot or will not accept motherhood. Sometimes it is a mental health issue. Not every woman immediately connects with her unborn child. Most doctors say when women struggle to form an attachment initially, once the baby quickens, their maternal instinct kicks in. But what if the maternal instinct never kicks in? Welcome to episode 119, Neonaticide, the Lindsay Lowe case. Lindsay Lowe was born and raised in Hendersonville, Tennessee, less than 20 miles from downtown Nashville in Sumner County. Sumner County lies on the border between Tennessee and Kentucky. It was once the home to several different Native American groups and cultures. Archaeological findings point to Paleo-Indian, Archaic, Woodland, and Mississippian cultures who visited the area for the bountiful land and hunting opportunities. The city of Hendersonville is known as the City by the Lake because it sits on Old Hickory Lake, which was man-made, constructed in the 1950s. The city was founded around the year 1784 by Revolutionary War General Daniel Smith, who first arrived there with his family, using land grants to settle and survey the area. Smith had big plans of developing a home and plantation with the grant. Within a few years, Rock Castle was erected, in large part thanks to Smith's wife, Sarah. The city was eventually named after Captain William Henderson, who moved to the area from Virginia with his wife in the 1790s. The Henderson family built a log home between Sanders and Walton Ferry roads and put down roots. In 1801, Captain Henderson became the city's first postmaster. During the Civil War, the city of Hendersonville, like the greater area of Sumner County, the state of Tennessee, and the South in general, was greatly impacted by the war. Many historical buildings and sites from the Civil War era still stand in the city today. The famed Rock Castle, which capitalized on the free labor of almost 100 enslaved Africans, was briefly occupied by the Union Army in 1862. One antebellum home, now called the Mont Haven Arts and Cultural Center, but called Liberty Hall during the war, served as a war hospital for wounded Union and Confederate soldiers. Most of the sites now serve as historic landmarks, event spaces, and areas for celebrating the history of the city. Many homegrown stars in the country music scene have either grown up in the city or owned property there at some point, including Johnny and June Cash, Conway Twitty, Taylor Swift, Thomas Rhett, and Kelly Clarkson, to name a few. If you grew up in the Middle Tennessee area, You may remember visiting Tweety City at Christmas time. I can still remember the magic of the thousands of twinkling lights and decorations at Tweety City when my family made our annual trip there. Sadly, the park and Conway's mansion were auctioned off a year after his death to Trinity Broadcasting Network, and it's now home to Huckabee Theater, where the evangelical politician Mike Huckabee broadcasts his television show. But Hendersonville is still mainly known for its country music stars. A five-mile stretch of Highway US 31 East that runs straight through Hendersonville is named Johnny Cash Parkway. The city has a population of over 57,000 people, falling within all levels of classes and walks of life with relatively low crime rates. Hendersonville's location makes it close enough to Nashville to enjoy the nightlife and music scene, but far enough to offer its residents a relative sense of peace and quiet within its many suburbs and upper middle class neighborhoods. One of those neighborhoods, Mansker Farms, has many two- and three-story houses, home to the sort of picture-perfect, all-American family that's part of our national imagination. Because as we know, looks can and usually are deceiving. The Lowe family was living in the Mansker Farms subdivision when their lives were turned upside down in 2011. Lindsay Brooke Lowe was born on August 29, 1986, in Hendersonville, Tennessee, to parents Mark and Paula Lowe. The Lowes were mildly affluent, easily affording their nice home in the upscale neighborhood. Mark Lowe was the manager of an automotive dealership. Paula Lowe was a homemaker, though she did sometimes do office work outside of the home. Lindsay was the oldest daughter in the Lowe family, and growing up, she was considered a role model for her younger sister, Lacey. Born 3 years apart, the sisters shared the same birthday. Like many families in the upper middle class of Hendersonville, Lindsay lived a fairly privileged but normal life growing up. She attended the private Good Pasture Christian High School in town and was active in swimming and dance. Along with her family, she attended the City Road United Methodist Church, where she sang in the choir and the praise band. According to court documents, Lindsay had a lot of friends, actively participated in church and community events, and was close to her conservative and religious parents. She was described as a good daughter, well-behaved, even meek, and always attentive to her family. She made good grades in school and was supported and loved by her parents and sister. During her senior year of high school, like many of her fellow classmates, Lindsay applied to Western Kentucky University, a school roughly an hour away from her hometown. Just far enough that she could remain close to her little sister and parents while still gaining more independence. Lindsay was delighted to learn she had gotten into Western, her first choice. While away from home for the first time, Lindsay learned to juggle school, relationships, and family responsibilities, something that became much harder when her mother was diagnosed with a benign brain tumor in 2005. Lindsay's mom underwent surgery to remove the tumor, but afterwards, she had a change in personality and also struggled to complete her usual household duties like cleaning, shopping, and cooking. As Lindsay dealt with school and the news of her mother's tumor, she traveled back home frequently to care for her mom and help out around the house. She spent many, if not most, of her weekends during her time at Western, driving to her parents' home and checking in on her family. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Despite the pressures Lindsay was feeling both at home and school, she met someone she really liked, fellow Western student Jonathan Brooks. They began dating soon after they met, and by 2008, the year of Lindsay's graduation, she and Jonathan were engaged. At the time of her graduation, Lindsay's new fiancé was still finishing up his degree, so Lindsay moved back home to continue caring for her mom, while Jonathan remained at Western, preparing for his own graduation. Living in separate cities was a strain on their relationship, but they made it work. Lindsay and Jonathan stuck things out, even as they remained physically separated after Jonathan's graduation in 2009 when he moved back to Louisville. Unfortunately, and coincidentally, Lindsay's future mother-in-law had also fallen ill, and Jonathan needed to stay nearby to help care for his mom. As she and Jonathan struggled to keep their connection and relationship strong, Lindsay sought out new friendships and experiences. Her dad later characterized their relationship as dysfunctional, but they stayed together anyway. In the spring of 2010, sometime around April or May, Lindsay was introduced to a man named Jeremy Smith. Jeremy was an acquaintance of Lindsay's cousin-in-law, who had introduced the two. They began texting each other after their introduction that spring. Despite the fact that Lindsay was engaged and Jeremy had a girlfriend at the time, their text messages became flirtatious. After just texting for a while, Lindsay and Jeremy met up in person, and then two more times between that spring and January of 2011. It was essentially just a sexual relationship, though they texted a lot. After their third date in January, Jeremy continued to pursue Lindsay, but she stopped returning his calls and texts with no explanation as to why. Probably because Lindsay soon realized that her period was late. She also noticed some unexpected weight gain, but afraid of what she might find out, she did not take a pregnancy test to be sure. Instead, Lindsay continued to go about her life as normal, not knowing that she was pregnant with twins. A few months later, in the spring of 2011, Lindsay's family and her fiancé's family were both struck with tragedy. Jonathan's mother passed away, and Paulo's brain tumor had returned. Lindsay continued to help around the home and tend to her mother, including now driving her back and forth to radiation therapy appointments. During this time, Lindsay was searching for a job in her field of study, which was interior design, but she was having trouble finding work. She eventually found a job at a pediatric dental office in the summer of 2011. At the office, she helped enter bills and insurance paperwork. It wasn't what she had pictured herself doing, but she enjoyed the job and liked the people she worked with. None of her coworkers suspected that Lindsay was pregnant. At the dental office, the dress code included scrubs and an optional long lab coat. Lindsay usually chose to wear the long black lab coat over her scrubs. Offices can be chilly, and everyone is different, so plenty of staff probably chose to wear the lab coat for comfort. Throughout that summer, Lindsay's life carried on like nothing was out of the ordinary. She continued to work at the dental office, she drove her mother to doctor's appointments, and she spent time with her friends and family. In September of 2011, Lindsay was preparing for her role as a bridesmaid in a friend's wedding. Her sister Lacey was also in the wedding party, and on the weekend of September 10th, 2011, Lindsay, Lacey, and a friend, Lindsay's sorority sister, a girl also named Lacey, packed into a car and traveled to Kentucky for the ceremony. At this point, Lindsay was 9 months pregnant, but she still fit into her bridesmaid's dress, which she had been fitted for back in January and again in February, when she was in the very early stages of her pregnancy. While at the wedding, all of the women in the bridal party changed their clothes in the same room. No one thought Lindsay looked pregnant, certainly not 9 months pregnant. Her sister had noticed that Lindsay had gained some weight, but didn't think much of it as her sister's weight had fluctuated throughout her life. Following the wedding, Lindsay, Lacey, and her friend all returned to Hendersonville together on that Sunday, September 11th. Lindsay's friend and sorority sister, Lacey McFadden, spent the night in the Lowe home, sharing Lindsay's bed, and not noticing anything unusual about her friend. The next day, Monday, started off normally, just like any other week for the Lowe family. Lindsay woke up and got ready for work, dressed in her scrubs, and headed into the dental office early. Throughout the day, she texted with several people and performed her tasks as usual. She made plans to go to a concert with her sister. She chatted with her fiancé about a future trip they planned to take together. And she sent a few texts back and forth to Lacey McFadden, who had spent the night with her. Later in the afternoon, Lindsay began to feel sick to her stomach. She finished off the workday and headed home, telling her family that she wasn't feeling well. Her parents thought she might have a stomach virus. Lindsay stayed locked inside the bathroom she shared with her sister, and her concerned family repeatedly checked in on her. Lindsay's mom went to the bathroom door twice to check on Lindsay, and on a third visit was accompanied by Lindsay's father. Lindsay assured her parents that she was going to be fine, but that she was sick. Knowing that Lindsay preferred to be left alone when she was sick, her parents and sister got ready for bed. At 10:39 p.m., Lacey texted her sister and said, "Let me know if you need anything. Love you. Good night." Lindsay was in pain, and she continued to stay in the bathroom. She later said she assumed she needed to make a bowel movement, so she sat on the toilet. And sometime during the night of Monday, September 12th, Lindsay gave birth to twin baby boys. The next day at 6:03 a.m., Lindsay texted a coworker to ask for the number of her supervisor. Once she got the number, Lindsay texted her supervisor to let her know that she had been up sick all night and would not make it into work that day. Lindsay told her supervisor that she would be back at work the next morning on Wednesday. Around that same time in the morning, Lindsay's sister used their shared bathroom and later said she did not notice anything out of the ordinary. While Lacey was in the bathroom, Lindsay called out to her and asked her to bring her a glass of water. Lacey brought her the water and asked her if she needed anything else before she left for work. Lindsay said no, and Lacey headed out for the day. During that morning, across the house, Mark Lowe was getting ready for work. He thought that Lindsay had something akin to a stomach flu and did not see her before leaving the house that day to drive his wife to work and go to work himself. Lindsay spent the rest of the morning at home by herself. Her father returned to the house on his lunch break and found Lindsay lounging on the couch in one of the upstairs rooms. He told her he thought she still looked sick, but Lindsay assured him she was feeling better. Once Mark returned to work, Lindsay was again alone in the house. She spent the afternoon recuperating and texting with her friends. She sent a text to her fiancé, telling him that she loved him, and ironically, texted back and forth with a friend who was pregnant and due later that month. The friend explained to Lindsay that she would be induced soon if the baby did not come on its own. Lindsay replied with, "Aw, I'm sorry. Well, I've been thinking about you. Hopefully she will get here before Monday." The two then chatted back and forth about the show, The Vampire Diaries. Lindsay texted her fiancé about the supposed virus she had the night before, and also texted back and forth with her sister about the upcoming concert they had planned to attend. It was like nothing had really happened, other than she did actually have a stomach bug. She made no further attempt to hide or dispose of the twin babies she had given birth to. Lindsay texted another friend about the concert plans she had made with her sister and about the stomach bug she had. She explained to her friend that she, quote, "Never went to bed last night. I just laid on the bathroom floor." And that night, with the baby stashed away, Lindsay went to bed and seemingly slept normally throughout the night. The following day, she returned to work as promised. She spent her morning filing and doing paperwork for the billing department. She sent a couple of benign texts to her dad and her fiancé. Back at the Lowe house, Lacey Lowe had left for work as usual, but Mark and his wife were still getting ready for the day. Paula Lowe was upstairs in Lindsay's room. She had decided to tidy up the space, hoping to make her oldest daughter feel a little better after she had been so sick the previous two nights. She noticed a laundry basket on the floor next to Lindsay's bed and began rifling through it to put a load in the washer. When she shouted for Mark, in what he would later describe as a panicked voice, Mark bounded up the stairs, where he was met with an unbelievable sight. Paula showed Mark the newborn baby inside the laundry basket. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsors. I love to cook, but I hate grocery shopping. I can never stick to a list, and I always overspend. But I found a solution with EveryPlate. You can get the meals you'll enjoy and your wallet will love delivered right to your door. EveryPlate dinners are also a less expensive and more fulfilling alternative to takeout or delivery. You definitely get more bang for your buck. With pre-portioned ingredients and easy-to-follow recipes that take around 30 minutes, you spend less time in the kitchen and more time enjoying a delicious meal with your family. And with a weekly changing menu of 14 recipes a week, you get so much to choose from. My family and I devoured the pub-style turkey burgers with caramelized onions, special sauce, and potato wedges. Much healthier and way tastier than fast food burgers. At first, I thought meal kits would be too expensive for my family, but I soon found that every plate is more affordable than most meal kits. I get the same deliciousness for a much lower price. Try every plate for just $1.99 per meal, plus an additional 20% off your next two boxes by going to everyplate.com and entering the code SOUTHERNFRIED199. Get started with every plate for just $1.99 per meal, plus an additional 20% off another 2 weeks by going to everyplate.com and entering code SOUTHERNFRIED199. That's everyplate.com and enter the promo code SOUTHERNFRIED199. Like many women, I love makeup, and I always want to look my best. But as I've gotten older, my priorities have changed. I still want to look great, but I have less time in front of the mirror, and I'm more concerned with long-term skincare. That's why I'm loving Thrive Cosmetics. Their clinically proven formulas not only highlight your best features, they actually improve your skin over time. Thrive Cosmetics is dedicated to strict, clean beauty standards. All their products are made with clean, high-performance, skin-loving ingredients formulated without parabens, sulfates, or phthalates. And Thrive Cosmetics never test on animals. They are PETA and Leaping Bunny approved, certified as 100% vegan and cruelty-free. Thrive Cosmetics also has a bold, bigger-than-beauty mission. For every product purchased, Thrive Cosmetics donates to causes that help women thrive, women who are fighting cancer, emerging from homelessness, and surviving domestic violence. As you know, intimate partner violence is a cause very close to my heart, so it means a lot to me to know a product I'm buying supports that cause and many others. I've bought several Thrive products, but their Liquid Lash Extensions Mascara is Thrive's top-selling product for a reason. My eyes popped and looked like I had grown longer lashes overnight. Visit thrivecosmetics.com/southernfried for 15% off your first order. This is an exclusive offer you can only get here. That's Thrive, C-A-U-S-E, medics.com/southernfried for 15% off your first order. That's thrivecosmetics.com/southernfried. In complete shock, Mark stared at the newborn child for almost 15 minutes, unsure of what to do and frozen in fear. Finally, he called a friend of his father's, who was an attorney. The man advised Mark to instead call his pastor. When the pastor heard Mark's story, he told him to call the police, and then he drove over to the Lowe house. Why the hell the attorney didn't advise Mark to call 911 is a mystery. Evidently, the pastor was bound more by moral ethics than the man sworn to uphold the law. According to court documents, sometime between 8:30 and 8:35 a.m., a dispatcher at the Hendersonville Police Department received a call from Mark Lowe. On the phone, Mark said, quote, "My daughter has gone to work, but apparently she has had a child in her room and it is not living." Police, fire, and medical personnel were all dispatched to the home. The first responding officer arrived on the scene shortly after the dispatch and was told by Mark that his 25-year-old daughter, Lindsay, had been really sick the night before. His wife had gone upstairs to clean Lindsay's room when she found a small, newborn baby in a laundry basket next to the bed. The officer checked on the infant, who was still inside the laundry basket, covered with a bloody towel and sheet. He found that the baby was cold to the touch and not breathing. A paramedic arrived soon after the officer, and she confirmed that the infant was dead. She touched the baby's arm and found no rigor mortis. The paramedic later testified and explained that it takes about 12 hours for full rigor mortis to set in, and then about 12 more for the body to come out of it. The timing fits for when Lindsay supposedly had been sick with a stomach virus and then went to bed to recuperate. It had been a full 24 hours. There was blood and fecal matter on the towel covering the infant. The baby appeared to be full term, and the medic estimated that it weighed about 5 pounds. She noted that there was no meconium stain on the baby, which would have indicated fetal distress. Meconium is the first stool a baby passes, but sometimes it comes out before birth and gets into the amniotic fluid, causing a stain on the baby when the mother's water breaks, and this increases the perinatal mortality by 5 times. Basically, that meconium staining, if it had been present, could have indicated that Lindsay's baby was born dead. There was fecal matter on the towel, but it could have came out after the birth or as the baby's muscles relaxed after death. Lindsay's parents were fully cooperative with the police. A detective sergeant from the Hendersonville police joined the other personnel on the scene at around 9 a.m. and began delegating tasks. He assigned Detective Steve Malik to interview Lindsay. Mark Lowe told Detective Malik where Lindsay worked so that he could pick her up from there. Mark asked the detective to take Lindsay to a hospital first because her blood type was Rh negative, and he was worried she might need medical care if she had in fact given birth unassisted. He asked Detective Malik if he could have an attorney present when the detective interviewed Lindsay, to which Malik replied that Lindsay was too old. It's not spelled out in court documents, but I think the detective meant that Lindsay needed to ask for an attorney, that her dad couldn't just send one to the station for her. Mark Lowe could have easily contacted an attorney for his daughter, no matter what Lindsay Lowe had done, and they were not even sure at the time she had a right to counsel. Technically, Lindsay would need to ask for an attorney, but the detective had not even talked to her yet. Her father was concerned for her health, as any dad would be, and especially considering the situation, Lindsay could have been in the midst of a mental health crisis. I think the detective jumped on the opportunity to question a woman who may have been in distress without an attorney present. Detective Malik arrived at the dental office where Lindsay worked, approaching the business in an unmarked car and dressed in a suit. Before speaking with Lindsay, the detective talked to her supervisor, asking to speak privately with one of her employees, named Lindsay. When the detective approached Lindsay, he found her wearing headphones and smiling as if nothing was out of the ordinary. Malik identified himself as a detective to Lindsay before asking her if she knew why he wanted to speak with her. Lindsay replied that she didn't know why. The detective told her they had found the laundry basket. Lindsay then became serious, dropping her smile. The detective explained that he wanted to speak with her in an effort to find out what had happened and asked her to be cooperative with him. Lindsay agreed, and the detective told her he would drive them in his car, saying kindly that she may not be able to drive. He said that he would read her rights once they arrived at the station. The detective then explained these rights to her briefly, and Lindsay agreed to ride with him. She got her purse out of her car and then rode, uncuffed, with the detective to the station. Malik later testified that they didn't discuss the baby because he was being friendly to build rapport. He said they chatted about Lindsay wanting to open up her own interior design business. During this time, back at the Lowe home, a detective still present took the official statements from Lindsay's parents about Lindsay's behavior the night before and how they found the infant in the laundry basket. At the station, the detective brought Lindsay into the interview room and read her her rights, which she chose to orally waive. He didn't have her sign a waiver. Then Lindsay began telling the detective about what had happened, and it was all caught on video. Video that would soon be released to the public. According to Lindsay, she knew she was pregnant, quote, probably almost the whole time, after she realized that she had not gotten her period and began gaining weight. She also admitted that she had begun lactating in the days leading up to giving birth. At first, Lindsay told the detective that her fiancé was the father of the child, but she didn't keep to this story for very long. After some pressure from the detective, Lindsay explained that Jonathan Brooks was not the father and that she had cheated on him with a man named Jeremy Smith. Lindsay told the detective that she had slept with Jeremy Smith twice, once in December and once in January. She said they did not use protection. According to Lindsay, she didn't tell her friends, family, or fiancé that she was pregnant because she was scared of disappointing them and losing her fiancé. Lindsay said that she had gone to a wedding from Thursday until Sunday, and then she went to work on Monday, despite not feeling well. She explained that when she got home, she did not eat dinner and began having intense back pain around 6:30 p.m. As the back pain worsened, she said she used the restroom around 9:30 p.m. She said she attempted to have another bowel movement a little after 10 p.m., but instead gave birth on the toilet. She said she realized she had given birth and that the baby went into the toilet as she fell to the bathroom floor. She said the baby cried for less than a minute and that she didn't check to see if it was submerged in the water. Then she told the detective that there were actually two babies. She explained that she eventually returned to the toilet and delivered the second baby and placenta and admitted that she never looked to see what sex the children were, and said she didn't touch them and didn't know if they were moving. The detective excused himself from the room, saying he was retrieving a tissue, but he was really running to tell the detective still at the house about the second baby. Lindsay said that the second child was born approximately 5 minutes after the first. She told the detective that she hadn't noticed if the babies were moving or not. According to Lindsay, after delivering the babies, she laid on the bathroom floor, unable to move. During this time, her family checked on her two or three times, but Lindsay insisted that she was okay and just feeling sick, that she didn't really need anything. After a while, Lindsay picked herself up and began washing the blood off the bathroom floor and surrounding area. Around 3 or 4 a.m. Tuesday morning, Lindsay said she used a towel to remove the infants from the toilet and placed them in the laundry basket. She told the detective that she washed herself off and managed to make it into her bedroom, again on the floor, before finally getting into bed at 6 a.m. Around 6:30 a.m., she heard her sister getting ready for work in the bathroom. It wasn't until noon that Lindsay was able to get out of bed, and when she did, she could only muster enough energy to make it to a couch in a nearby room. She said she did not check on the babies once throughout the day. She placed the clothes that she had worn the previous night, covered in blood, in her closet and moved to a different couch before finally returning to bed and going to sleep that evening. The next morning, she simply went back to work, with the infants still in the laundry basket. She told the detective that she had no plans for what to do with the babies. And even though her mom did sometimes do her laundry, she didn't think her parents would find the bodies. After hearing her story, the detective paused for a second. He cautioned Lindsay that they would be able to tell during the autopsy how the children had died, quote, whether they drowned, were thrown against a wall, or if someone had their hand over their mouth. He warned Lindsay not to ruin the progress that they had made so far, and her cooperation by leaving out details of the story. Lindsay then told the detective that she had in fact looked at the sex of the first child and had noticed the baby had a bowel movement. The detective then urged Lindsay to be truthful about all of the details, to which she responded, quote, I guess it was more, the first time was a little louder, so I mean, I don't think they were definitely not like drowning, but maybe just kind of like, I don't know. I don't want to call it smother. I was just trying to keep them quiet. He asked her, how were you doing that? Lindsay said, just put my hand down there over the mouth. The detective asked, over the baby's mouth? Lindsay nodded her head yes. Then he asked, "How long would you say you did that for?" She replied, "Not very long." The detective asked, "Until it stopped crying?" She said, I guess, I don't know." The detective replied, I understand. As if she was realizing for the first time what all had happened and what she had done, Lindsay said, "Oh my God." The detective said, I know. It's okay. Lindsay then told the detective that the second baby did not cry as much and that, quote, "It was just the same thing, and I guess I just put my hand over the mouth." The detective summarized what Lindsay had told him and repeated it back to her. In response, Lindsay agreed that he had understood her statements correctly. She admitted that she knew, when she put her hand on the baby's mouth, that they could not breathe. She agreed that she had killed each of the babies, that they were, quote, "clearly alive," and that she had clearly killed them. The detective that was still at the Lowe home speaking with Lindsay's parents had been alerted that there was a second baby inside the home by Detective Malik. A search warrant had not yet been obtained. However, upon hearing that there was a second baby, officers quickly ran upstairs to find the child and see if it was alive. Inside the laundry basket where the first baby had been found, the detectives located the body of the second infant. As one of the detectives removed the sheet and towel that the first infant rested under onto the nearby bed, he realized that the child's umbilical cord was attached to something inside of the basket. While one officer held the already discovered infant, another began removing items within the laundry basket until he came across the body of the second child, still attached by the umbilical cord to his twin brother. The detectives also uncovered the placenta. The umbilical cord was lying around the neck and shoulder of the second infant, but did not appear to be wrapped around its neck. The detectives confirmed that this second baby was also deceased and noted that he seemed smaller than his brother, around 3 to 4 pounds. Both of the infants were placed back inside the basket. The detectives brought the laundry basket, carrying the babies, outside to an emergency vehicle, where each child was tagged around the ankle with baby Low 1 and baby Low 2, based on when each of them had been discovered. While inside the home, none of the detectives noticed anything that indicated that Lindsay was expecting to care for a child, like diapers, bottles, or anything else. A search warrant was executed at the home shortly after. The detective in charge of carrying out the warrant did not see any blood within Lindsay's bedroom or her shared bathroom, but testing would later reveal the trace of blood and biological matter on the toilet, bathroom floor, and on a patch of carpet within Lindsay's bedroom. The detective did find bloodied towels and sheets, along with bloodied pairs of underwear, pajama pants, and a t-shirt in Lindsay's closet. A package of Kendall Curity maternity pads were found inside a trash bag inside Lindsay's room. Which is telling, because as I said, the officers found no signs that Lindsay was preparing for a newborn. No diapers, no clothes, no crib. Nothing like that was found. Detective Malik attended the autopsy and told the medical examiner that the defendant had admitted that she had smothered the babies. The forensic pathologist found that both of the babies weighed 6.5 pounds and had reached a gestational age of 40 weeks, so they were born full term. Neither of the twins appeared to have any birth defects or abnormalities. Both of the twins had a subgaleal hemorrhage, a common and mild injury that occurs in vaginal births. At the end of the autopsy, the doctor determined that both babies had died from being smothered. The official report listed the manner of deaths as homicides. A paternity test concluded that Jeremy Smith, not Lindsay's fiancé, was the father of the twins. The tests also concluded that the twins were fraternal. Following the interview with Lindsay, the detective finally transported her to the hospital in order to ensure she was healthy and had no lasting physical injuries from giving birth unassisted. After this, Lindsay was placed under arrest and indicted for 2 counts of first-degree premeditated murder, 2 counts of first-degree felony murder and the perpetration of aggravated child abuse, and 2 counts of aggravated child abuse. She was placed in the custody of Sumner County Jail. I'm going to pause now to hear a final word from today's sponsors. Is there something bothering you? Sometimes my anxiety can make me just freeze up. It interferes with my productivity. BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for us. They will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. BetterHelp has over 3,000 licensed therapists in all 50 states, treating depression, anxiety, stress, trauma, grief, and other issues that so many of us suffer from. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. The service is also available to clients worldwide. From your phone, laptop, or tablet, you can connect with a professional counselor via text, chat, phone, or video and start communicating with your counselor in under 24 hours. And you can send a message to your counselor at any time. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, and you can schedule weekly sessions with your counselor by video or phone, whichever makes you more comfortable. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so it is easy and free to change counselors if you want to, and anything you share is confidential. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and there is even financial aid available. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/southern. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/southern. Following her arrest, the media took up the story of the baby killer. Tabloids, local, national, and international, told the story of how Lindsay Lowe, a 25-year-old suburban woman, had smothered her newborn twins to death in an effort to appease her religious parents and cover up her illicit affair. The local news ran frequent updates on the story, and members of the public even created petitions demanding the maximum sentence for Lindsay. In the week following her arrest, a court hearing was held to set Lindsay's bond. Friends and family spoke on Lindsay's behalf. Her father, Mark Lowe, said, quote, "She's as good as it gets. She's a good girl. I love her very much." Lindsay's cousin took the stand, stating that she had known Lindsay her entire life. She said, quote, "She's kind, loving, and has a beautiful smile, and she can always light up a room." Since she had arrived at the jail, Lindsay was placed on suicide watch. Her bond was set for $250,000. Lindsay posted bail 2 days after the court hearing and was able to leave the Sumner County Jail on September 20, 2011. She was now able to await her trial in the comfort of her home and with the support of her friends and family. Leading up to the trial on August 6, 2012, Lindsay and her defense team filed a motion to suppress the statements she had given to the Hendersonville police. On November 5, 2012, the trial court denied the motion. The videotaped confession that Lindsay had given to the detective would be admissible in court, and it was to be damning evidence. The trial started in March of 2013, and the proceedings were fraught with high emotions. The prosecution built a case that centered on Lindsay's cognizant and intentional murder of her twin babies. The prosecution said that Lindsay had never wanted and never planned to allow the babies to live or interfere in her life. To drive the point home, they showed graphic autopsy photos to the jury. Lindsay cried and covered her eyes as the photos were shown. The officers that were involved in the case took the stand to detail how they found the babies wrapped in a bloodied sheet and towel within a laundry basket, and they visibly fought back tears and emotion as they gave their statements. The defense focused their attention on Lindsay's mental health, trying to make a case that she had diminished capabilities at the time of the crime. Lindsay's defense attorney told the jury, quote, "Lindsay Lowe was pregnant, but she refused to accept it. Her mind refused to accept it." Those who knew and worked with Lindsay were called as witnesses during the trial, and Mark Lowe testified he had never suspected his daughter to be pregnant. Lacey Lowe agreed with their father, and she had never heard anyone else speculate that Lindsay was pregnant. While on the stand, Lacey explained that her sister had gained some weight, but nothing out of the ordinary. She explained that she typically saw her sister wearing scrubs for work and big t-shirts at home, something that she never found odd. Her supervisor and coworker testified, and both of them said they saw no signs that Lindsay was pregnant, nor had they heard any rumors from the rest of the staff. I want to point out here that in all photos I've seen of Lindsay, she appeared to be a heavier set woman. I am not fat shaming. It's no secret that plus-size women often do not appear to be pregnant. I did not find any photos of Lindsay much earlier in life, even though I do have one of her in that wedding party photo when she is 9 months pregnant. But from what her family says about her fluctuating weight and her appearance in almost all photos, I think it's fair to say she was overweight, and in fact, her weight yo-yoed, probably from dieting. It would not have been hard to hide the pregnancy, and to play devil's advocate, it wouldn't have been hard to suffer from pregnancy denial at that body weight. The forensic pathologist who conducted the autopsies on the twins testified that the babies were born breathing and alive. To support this, the pathologist pointed out that the baby's lungs floated when he placed them in water. If the babies had been stillborn, their lungs would not have aerated or floated in the water during this test. The forensic pathologist also testified that although the umbilical cord was found around the neck of baby Lo 2, there was no indentation or hemorrhage in the neck muscles, meaning that the baby was not strangled to death by the umbilical cord. The pathologist testified that the babies were the victims of homicide and that the cause of death was smothering. Additionally, the doctor elaborated that the conclusion of smothering, quote, comes down to a documentation to a lack of injuries, meaning, of course, what Lindsay had confessed to Detective Malik. The pathologist testified that much of this conclusion was based on the investigation and information provided to him by the detective. When prompted, the pathologist acknowledged that if the placenta had been delivered on top of one of the babies inside of the toilet, it could have caused the smothering, as well as if one of the babies was delivered on top of the other. The doctor also described how newborns typically cannot regulate their temperature, and that being born in water could cause hypothermia and death by exposure within minutes to hours. According to the doctor's testimony, death from hypothermia would look the same as death from smothering in a newborn. While on the stand, the doctor also acknowledged that a mother could lose consciousness while giving birth, especially if she suffered from blood loss, and that if the mother was unable to tend to the newborn, the child could die from exposure. The father of the twins, Jeremy Smith, was called to the stand. Smith testified that he and Lindsay went on 3 dates, each ending with sex, and they only used protection on 2 of the occasions. According to Smith, he told Lindsay that he wanted to marry her and have children with her before they even went on their first date, despite being in a relationship with another woman and knowing that Lindsay was engaged to Jonathan Brooks at the time. The pair's texts were entered into evidence, showing flirty messages back and forth starting in November of 2010. He denied ever forcing himself on Lindsay and stated that Lindsay had never told him that she did not want to have sex. He told the jury and the courtroom that he would have taken care of the twin boys and denied that he had failed to pay child support for an already existing daughter. This was later confirmed to be a lie, as Jeremy Smith was charged with flagrant non-support of his daughter. Lindsay's younger sister had testified that she knew Jeremy Smith had been bothering Lindsay through text. At the time, she wasn't aware that her sister eventually began responding to these texts. One thread of messages included a time where Lindsay was attempting to arrange a date at a bar, to which Smith declined because he was with his girlfriend. In response to this rejection, Lindsay asked, "Why did you ask me to marry you if you were with her?" And Smith responded, "'Cause I want to marry you. I want you to be the mother of my kids." Throughout the trial, a heavy focus was placed on Lindsay's mental stability at the time of the crime. Lindsay's defense called on her treating psychiatrist, Dr. William Kenner, to provide context around Lindsay's mental health. Most of her version of events was relayed through Dr. Kenner through the trial. In preparation for the trial, Dr. Kenner had interviewed Lindsay extensively for 13 hours and reviewed text messages, medical reports, Lindsay's statement to the detective, and her psychological reports. Dr. Kenner testified he believed that Lindsay responded to psychological questions honestly. He testified that Lindsay, due to her timid and passive nature, was more inclined to let someone else, like the detective, fill in the gaps in her story than tell her version of events from her own memory. He testified that he believed Lindsay had become frozen and then numb when she gave birth to the twins in her bathroom. According to Dr. Kenner, Lindsay had developed a coping mechanism of disassociation in the face of pain and discomfort after enduring multiple surgeries for a urinary tract malformation in her early teen years. When these disassociative states would happen, Lindsay would feel as if the events taking place were happening outside of herself and to someone else entirely. This, according to Dr. Kenner, was what had happened the night she gave birth. In reference to Jeremy Smith's testimony, Dr. Kenner stated that when Lindsay described her sexual encounters with Smith, he believed she had been raped. Based on what Lindsay had told Dr. Kenner, when she met up with Jeremy Smith the first time to watch a movie, Jeremy lived with his grandparents, and it seemed innocent enough. When she arrived, she learned that the TV was in Smith's room, not a common area, and once they were alone, he began pressuring her for sex. She told him she didn't want to have sex, but he put pressure on her thighs, which caused her pain, and she let it happen to, quote, get it over with. Dr. Kenner told the court that Lindsay's dissociative disorder caused her to not fight back during the event and caused some amnesia about the details. The second time she was with Jeremy, she was spending time at a friend's house drinking, and he asked to join her. Lindsay told Jeremy he could come, knowing that he did not have a driver's license and assuming that he would not actually have a way to get there. Instead, Jeremy did show up, and Lindsay said she could not remember anything after his arrival. At the root of his testimony, Dr. Kenner put forth that Lindsay had suffered from pregnancy denial, something that can actually result in physical effects, such as a fetus being carried vertically. This would allow a pregnant woman to not appear pregnant. A woman suffering from this could, according to Dr. Kenner, at times be lucid enough to know she was pregnant, but would overall and in general be unaware of the pregnancy. Dr. Kenner stated, quote, probably 99.5% of the time she considered herself not pregnant. There were probably these, oh shoot, moments where, you know, something came to her like, you know, I am pregnant. That's what typically happens with these women, he said. Dr. Kenner testified that if a woman suffering from pregnancy denial was shown irrefutable evidence that she had been pregnant after giving birth, she would likely admit that she had known the entire time and the denial would be over. In essence, the facade would be shattered. Dr. Kenner pointed out that Lindsay never dreamt of babies, never thought about decorating or buying clothes, which he said was a symptom of pregnancy denial. Dr. Kenner testified that the night that Lindsay gave birth, she actually thought she was dying until she felt an ear. She told Dr. Kenner that she had not put her hand on the baby's mouths and had not felt any identifiable part of the baby, only an area that was, quote, just kind of plain, indicating to Dr. Kenner that she was trying to comfort the baby by patting his back. Dr. Kenner said that he had diagnosed the defendant with chronic post-traumatic stress disorder, dissociative disorder, and major depressive disorder, chronic and severe. Due to blood loss induced hypovolemic shock, Dr. Kenner believed that Lindsay had suffered from delirium, similar to dementia patients after giving birth. Lindsay had told Dr. Kenner that she felt dizzy, blacked out, and had hit her head a few times after giving birth. And these claims of blood loss were supported by the jail nurse, who stated that even days after giving birth, Lindsay was still suffering pallor and dehydration. All of these factors, according to Dr. Kenner, meant that Lindsay had a diminished capacity at the time and could not have the intent to purposefully commit murder. During cross-examination, Dr. Kenner acknowledged that Lindsay admitted she knew she was pregnant to the detective, but testified that this did not mean she did not suffer from pregnancy denial during the course of her pregnancy, because at that point, she had given birth and the facade had been broken. During the cross-examination, the prosecution also pointed to Google searches that had been made from Lindsay's phone. The prosecution asked Dr. Kenner if he was aware of the searches, including pregnancy calculator on September 3rd, pregnant and doctor porn on September 5th, free videos of pregnant sex and things to make you go into labor on September 6th, and how to make yourself go into labor on September 9th. That was the day before Lindsay left for the wedding in Kentucky, 3 days before she gave birth. In response, Dr. Kenner stated that those suffering from pregnancy denial could segment their behaviors and execute certain actions and still not be fully aware that they are in fact pregnant. Dr. Kenner seemed to suggest Lindsay's mental issues allowed her body to physiologically hide her pregnancy. He believes the twins sat vertically inside of her, which allowed her to carry them to full term without being noticed. A forensic psychologist, Dr. Pamela Auble, had also assessed Lindsay 10 days after she gave birth. While on the stand, Dr. Auble stated that Lindsay was introverted and that she was prone to withdrawing within herself in times of stress. She also stated that Lindsay used disassociation to handle unpleasant situations. Lindsay told Dr. Auble that she knew she was pregnant, but coped by telling herself she wasn't, or that she was sick instead. Lindsay told Dr. Auble, quote, "It runs through my mind 1,000 times a day. Why didn't you ask for help? But I just wanted to die." She told Dr. Auble that after the first baby was born, quote, "My mind just shut off all feeling and everything. It all went away. I don't know. I just wanted it over." Like Dr. Kenner, Dr. Auble also diagnosed Lindsay with chronic depressive disorder, dissociative disorder, and post-traumatic stress disorder. She stated that Lindsay was unable to form the intent for first-degree murder. Dr. Auble acknowledged that during her assessment, Lindsay told her that her biggest mistake had been being unfaithful to her fiancé. In response to the defense's witness that testified about Lindsay's mental health, the state called their own forensic psychologist, Dr. John Hudson, who testified for the prosecution. He agreed that Lindsay suffered from major depression and post-traumatic stress disorder, but he did not agree that she suffered from dissociative disorder. He testified that regardless of whether she did or not, dissociative disorder would not have made her lose her cognitive abilities. She simply would have felt that she was not a part of the events happening around her. Dr. Hudson came to this conclusion because Lindsay did not have a history of losing time while driving or showing up late to things, and that she chose to clean areas of the home that were common spaces but not private rooms, which indicated to the doctor that she was capable of making rational decisions. He also stated that Lindsay's refusal of her parents' or sister's assistance the night she gave birth, and the fact that she did not seek help when she was giving birth, meant that she was in fact not experiencing pregnancy denial. That may be true, but she could also have been in shock and weak from blood loss, which Dr. Hudson did acknowledge. He testified that Lindsay had the mental capabilities to commit the crime at the time, but agreed that extreme blood loss could cause loss of consciousness and hallucinations. Throughout the trial, Lindsay remained extremely emotional, frequently crying and at times even covering her ears to avoid listening to some of the witness testimonies. During the trial, Lindsay was frequently photographed carrying a copy of the Bible. Several times throughout the trial, the defense asked for a break in order for Lindsay to calm down and collect herself. After Jeremy Smith's testimony, Lindsay became increasingly upset and was inconsolable. The judge, out of the jury's presence, addressed her defense team and said, I'm concerned about your client. She is acting like a child. She has her head down, her ears covered, and I'm not going to tolerate that. Is she on medication? Is she okay? In the judge's chamber, the judge again privately addressed Lindsay's defense attorney. He acknowledged that it was an emotional trial, but said Lindsay, quote, looked like a child that wasn't getting her way. He said if it happened again in court, he would warn her himself. Lindsay's attorney argued that his client was suffering from mental health issues and was fragile, but court reconvened and the judge soon made good on his threat. In open court, in front of the jury, the judge told Lindsay that while he was trying to be sensitive to her emotions, the jury had a hard enough time deciding this case based on the evidence and the law, and quote, I will not have you sitting there acting like a child or displaying emotion uncontrolled. He then threatened to exclude her from the courtroom if she didn't straighten up and said, do I make myself clear? Lindsay was ultimately unable to take the stand and told the judge as much. I just don't feel I can emotionally handle it, she said. Lindsay's defense team then made a motion for a mistrial on the basis of the judge's comments toward their client. Her attorney said the judge showed bias by saying she was acting like a child in open court when Lindsay became visibly upset. The judge denied this motion, stating, quote, the defendant's action of putting her head down and covering her ears with her hands was a known intentional response, and it was childlike. And this is a sticky part for me. Judges are supposed to be impartial, and he could have dressed her down away from the jury. Lots of criminal defendants cry and show emotion without being removed from the courtroom. I only included a couple of sentences in the judge's speech to Lindsay because it was way too long. He simply could have called for a recess and asked her attorneys to remove her from the room if he felt her conduct was that bad. I think his long-winded lecture did show bias. And despite her crimes, Lindsay Lowe was entitled to a fair and unbiased trial. After the 7-day trial, the jury found 26-year-old Lindsay Lowe guilty of all charges. Despite her emotions throughout the trial, she remained calm as the verdict was read. Before being led away from the court, she turned to her family, Bible in hand, and mouthed, I'm okay, I love you all, he's with me, as she pointed upward towards the ceiling. During the sentencing phase that took place almost a month later, Lindsay's defense team submitted a scrapbook of her life, as well as 88 letters of support from friends, family, and members of her church, all detailing acts of selflessness and commitment to her loved ones and faith. Dr. Auble testified that Lindsay's actions were part of a situational crime and that she was unlikely to ever commit another act like that again. She stated that Lindsay was amenable to rehabilitation. 8 character witnesses from friends and family were called to speak about Lindsay's agreeable, nonviolent, and friendly personality. Lindsay herself stated that she could not understand why she put her babies in the laundry basket or what she was thinking, but acknowledged her responsibility in their deaths and said she was sorry. At the end of the hearing, Lindsay Lowe, 26 years old, was sentenced to a life sentence for each murder conviction and to 25 years for each aggravated child abuse conviction. All of her sentences were to run concurrently. Afterward, the district attorney said, quote, it was a sad situation for a young lady to get a life sentence, but she's the one who did it. In ordering the maximum sentence on the child abuse charges, the judge said he found Lindsay to be untruthful and selfish and called it a tragedy that so many people believed in her version of events. He further said that her statement in a letter to the judge claiming she did not know she was pregnant was not credible, and he chided her for writing that the baby's father had date raped her. Just how in the world is that relevant? He asked. And is it supposed to devalue the lives of those children? There are serious problems in you taking responsibility for what you did. Judge D. David Gay used the words of the controversial Focus on the Family founder, James Dobson, saying, quote, our children are the true wealth of any nation, and added that we cannot become a, quote, child-killing society that views children as burdens rather than blessings. The judge ended his tirade by saying Lindsay Lowe's selfishness was reflected in her cheating on her fiancé in the affair that led to her pregnancy and her, quote, completely neglecting the work of creation in her body. He also read off a list of web searches for pornographic websites made on Lo's computer in the month before she gave birth, suggesting that it showed where her priorities lay. Despite his admonitions, the judge did say he could not sentence Lo to serve the sentences consecutively because he could not find that she posed a danger to society, one of the necessary legal factors. At this point, Lindsay was convicted. He simply could have sentenced her based on the severity of her crimes without spouting religious rhetoric. Supposedly, we have a separation of church and state in this country. Since Judge Gay decided to invoke the words of the strongly evangelical James Dobson, let's address the elephant in the room. Lindsay Lo did have choices. Abortion was one of them. I mentioned that she was raised religiously, and while it was heavily mentioned in the press, it wasn't raised at trial that she didn't consider abortion because of her religion. But then, her defense was based on diminished capacity, so they wouldn't have brought that up. But it had to have crossed her mind. And if she and her family were as conservative and religious as they are portrayed, abortion would not have been a choice for Lindsay Lo. This case has been very hard to wrap my head around. I've always told you guys I am way more interested in the why in any case. Why would she do this? From the outset, I felt she may have had a mental break. There is a whole television show about women who didn't know they were pregnant. It does happen. And pregnancy denial is as real as pseudocyesis. That's the condition where a woman wants a baby so badly, she truly believes she is pregnant, to the point of showing physical symptoms. The same is true and opposite in its symptoms for pregnancy denial. In preparation for Lindsay's appeal, her defense attorney pointed to photos taken at the wedding 2 days before delivery, used as evidence in the trial. For him, they reveal a woman, full term with twins, wearing the same unaltered dress she fit into 9 months earlier. He said, quote, "She didn't walk like a pregnant lady. She didn't look like a pregnant lady. She didn't act like a pregnant lady. By and large, she just somehow disassociated, pushed it out of her mind, and just did not accept it." I think it is certainly a possibility. The problem is, Lindsay cleaned up after the birth. And in the video confession, she did say she covered the mouths of the babies to stop them crying. She could have been in shock and scared, but these acts do show rational thinking. However, putting the babies in a laundry basket and carrying on with her life as if nothing had happened does not. She was home for a full day. She could have gotten rid of the bodies, but she didn't. On direct appeal, the Court of Criminal Appeals affirmed the trial court's judgments and upheld Lindsay's convictions. 4 years after his newborn sons were killed, Jeremy Smith spoke with the local news about how he reacted to finding out that Lindsay had been pregnant with his children and that she had killed them before he even had a chance to know. He told the reporter, "This should never have taken place. She had choices. She had options. I still have no reason on why she done it or how she could do something like this." Jeremy Smith further said, quote, "I'm a twin. They were twins. You imagine the bond that I would have had with these little boys. What really gets me is Tennessee is a safe haven state. It's an everyday nightmare. I wake up with it and I go to bed with it." He echoes the dilemma a lot of people have with this case. Why? In 2015, Lindsay, along with the help of a new defense attorney, began seeking a new trial, based on a claim that the Hendersonville Police Department used deceit and trickery to get Lindsay to say that she had used her hand to smother the first baby, and then proceeded to do the same to the second baby. The motion for a new trial excluding the confession was denied. I do believe that Lindsay should have been taken to the hospital first. I think Detective Malik refused to do this because he knew he had the opportunity to question her without her parents getting their wits about them and hiring an attorney. Even her jail nurse testified that she seemed confused and showed signs of blood loss and dehydration. But ultimately, the detective was gentle with Lindsay during questioning, and I'm not sure I believe he put words in her mouth. I do think he was a very skilled interrogator. He did not shout. He did not bully her. He spoke softly and sounded sympathetic. But I still don't believe that Lindsay would have stood up to his authority and asked for an attorney, even though it was obviously in her best interest. And it is possible he planted an idea in her mind when he warned her about the autopsy findings with these words. Whether they drowned or thrown against a wall, or if someone had their hand over their mouths. Her psychiatrist and a forensic psychologist both described her as malleable, a weak personality, easily manipulated, who suffered from disassociation. By law, the detective was not in the wrong and his interrogation was allowed in court. But to me, morally, I wish Lindsay had been treated by medical staff before she was taken in for questioning. Most recently, in 2019, Lindsay and her team filed a motion for post-conviction relief, which, if granted, allows a defendant the opportunity to raise new pieces of evidence or issues about a case post-trial. The judge, the same one that presided over Lindsay's original trial, granted the motion, and the date was set for August 25, 2020. At this time, I am unable to find any updates about the post-conviction relief hearing that was scheduled for August of last year. I believe it is held up in the backlog of cases due to the pandemic. Perhaps she will get another chance, but I don't have much hope for this. Public opinion is most certainly against her. Lindsay Lowe is currently still imprisoned in the Deborah K. Johnson Rehabilitation Center in Nashville. She is now 35 years old. She will be eligible for parole at the age of 77. I don't want to leave you with the impression that I only sympathize with Lindsay Lowe. Of course not. She killed her newborn babies. Her actions are abominable, unthinkable, unforgivable. We cannot understand why she did this. We hold an ancient disgust in our very DNA against women like Lindsay. And whether or not you agree with abortion, we all understand and appreciate safe haven laws. It's difficult for people like us to understand what was going on in Lindsay's mind. She was a 25-year-old woman. She had choices. How could she make this choice unless she is evil? Surely, if she was too religious to consider abortion, then how could she kill her babies once they were born? And this is why my mind and heart go back to her mental health. I do believe this is another example of our justice system failing to address mental illness, and we lack the legislation to help people who are in distress. I've said many times that our prisons are filled with the mentally ill. A successful diminished capacity defense is incredibly hard to win. You must prove the defendant was insane at the time of the murder. Was Lindsay truly disassociating when she smothered her twins? I suppose that question is really between Lindsay and her God. Southern Fried True Crime is produced by me, Erica Kelly. Today's episode was researched and written by Hannah Newcomb, with additional writing by me. All opinions are my own. The audio is edited and mixed by Ches Gray of Gray Multimedia. Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio, and the original graphic art is by Coley Horner. Thank you so much for your patience and your well wishes and love. You guys have really kept my spirits up. It's so good to be back. If you're not already a member, come join my Facebook group. While we do discuss crime, we also share memes and have a lot of laughs. Some members find it a place of comfort, a pleasant little corner of Facebook, as we have firm rules and our motto is no shit asses allowed. We worship our patron saint, Dolly Parton, share recipes and personal stories, and do our best to be good to one another. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify, as well as Stitcher Premium, where you can listen ad-free. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I do not accept suggestions on social media private messages. But please feel free to reach out by email. Not only do I get my most interesting and little-known cases from listener suggestions, I love hearing from you guys. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.